session of Health Committees, House and Senate together, and we have the great pleasure of having Dr. Perry with us today. I don't know how well you can see the screen from where you are. You might want to move around a little bit to adjust your seating. This is a bad situation for people on this side. Okay, we're running a little bit behind schedule, so with no further ado, I will introduce Mickey Lansing, who will introduce our guest. Mickey?
Thank you, Chair Morissette and members of the Joint Committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. In behalf of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, it is my pleasure to introduce to you today Dr. Bruce Perry. Dr. Perry is a senior fellow at the Child Trauma Academy, one of this nation's foremost experts on the impact of early child abuse on brain development. His experience as a clinician and a researcher with traumatized children has led many community and governmental agencies to consult Dr. Perry following high-profile incidents involving traumatized children. These include the Branch Davidian siege, the Oklahoma City bombing, the Columbine school shootings, and the September 11th terrorist attacks. We asked Dr. Perry to speak with you today to share his perspective on government's role in early childhood policy. This is important to Oregon because increasingly, research leads us to understand where we can make the most impact with limited public funds. Three areas that are very important, there are many, but three that research tells us, is that 85% of core brain structures for all future functioning are established by the age of three. That chaos, neglect, and violence in early childhood result in disorganized and underdeveloped brains. And that programs to support and strengthen the family will increase the likelihood of optimal childhood outcomes. Dr. Perry is known both nationally and internationally for his work in this particular area. As I greeted him, I said, "Your reputation precedes you." He is almost bigger than life, and wherever he goes, he fills the rooms where he is. So it is my pleasure. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Perry to Oregon.
Rarely do we allow an outburst of emotion, but I guess you warrant it, so that's
fine. Well, first of all, thank you very much for taking time to give me this opportunity, and thank you for asking me to come, and thank all of you. I apologize that I'm not going to be looking at you. I have a swivelly chair here. Let me just start by saying that you have an incredible state. I have had the opportunity in the last couple of years to drive around a bit and to meet lots of people in your state, and you have incredible programs in lots of communities, and I think you have a lot to be proud of, and I am very, very privileged to be here to share some of the things that we've been doing with you as you try to struggle with the incredibly difficult task of figuring out how to use the limited resources that you have to try to make the communities you live in and your state better. And with that spirit, what I want to do is share with you some of the concepts that I think will help you struggle with these issues in a way that I hope will lead to good decision making and wise use of those resources. A big part of what I'm going to talk about today is the role that you all play in inventing things. You are basically inventors. You are creating new policy, new practice, new law. You're inventing things that will help shape your communities. And this is an incredibly difficult task. And all decision making at any level is always based upon the quality of the data you have to consider when you're making decisions. So, again, I hope that what I have to say is helpful in that process. And I'm not sure that at the end of this I'm going to be able to say this is exactly what will help and this is what you should do, but I do think that it will help you think carefully about some of the things that need to be taken into consideration. The first thing I want to say is, I'm sorry I broke your mic here. The first thing I want to say is that, you know, everybody in this room is here because they really want to make their communities better. And I think, you know, no one ever really argues with the fact that our children are our future. It's sort of a very common political mantra. It's, people talk about it all the time. Part of what the challenge is, I think, is that people in my position who've been studying children and how children develop have been very, very ineffective at communicating clearly to people who make decisions about how children should be educated, how they should be cared for, how they should get mental health services, child protective services, juvenile justice services. We've done a very, very poor job of communicating. And I think part of that is we ourselves are not very good at understanding what actually happens over the course of an individual's life and how that's connected not just to the future, but how it's really a product of the past. Everything that we do, our language, our dress, our style of governance, our policies and practices, are really all products of a transgenerational decision-making. People have made choices about what we pass on. People have decided that we're going to wear a colored cloth around our neck as a sign of respect. People have decided that we are going to govern ourselves this way. You have decided in this state that you're going to meet every 2 years instead of every 1 year to have the legislature. We make choices all the time. And the way we function in any given moment is a product of thousands of decisions that have been accumulated and then passed on. The way we live today is not necessarily a product of our genes. There's no genes that make us decide to hold the legislature every 2 years. There's no genes that make us speak English. There are genes that allow us to speak, that make the sounds that come out of our mouth, and there are genes that allow us to make an association, a connection between a sound and an object. But English is invented. You take a child and you raise that child in the absence of the spoken word, they won't speak English or Japanese or Chinese or anything. So what I'm going to talk about, this whole, the entire permeating theme of this presentation, is that the choices that we make about how we raise our children, how we educate our children, how we protect, heal, and nurture our children, literally is going to shape the trajectory of our species. And the organ that allows us to do that is the brain. Human beings are different from any other animal in the known biological kingdom. Our brain has the capacity to make memory more efficiently than any other species. And because of that, we can take the accumulated experiences of all these other generations and pass them forward and forward and forward and forward. We accumulate knowledge and facts and information and ways of living. And we pass that on to the next generation, not in our genes, but in our actions. What we teach our children, how we shape their world, literally changes their brain. So 5,000 years ago, every single human being on this planet had the potential to learn how to read and write, except a few who had unusual genetic abnormalities. But the vast majority of them did. But not a single person on the planet could read or write. We had not yet invented written language. Written language didn't exist 5,000 years ago. Our brain did. 200 years ago, every single person, every single Caucasian boy, every single Caucasian girl, every single African-American boy and girl had the potential to learn how to read. But some of those kids were given patterned, repetitive, cognitive instruction, and they learned how to read, and that changed their brains, and some of those children were not. Right now, everybody in this room probably has a genetic potential. If you could learn how to read, you probably have the genetic potential to learn how to read music. But not everybody in this room knows how to read music because it was not something that was provided in a pattern, repetitive, consistent way. The point I want to make is this. Your brain is this incredible, malleable organ that has a whole range of potentials. Those potentials will only be expressed, however, if at key times during development there's patterned, repetitive experience to allow that organization to take place. All of these things are inventions. They're products of the accumulated experience of thousands of previous generations, and they're things that we have passed on generation after generation after generation. And some of the things that we pass on are good. I think written word is great. I think English is a great language. Some of the things we pass on, though, are not good. Some of the things we've invented are stupid. Usually these things have been invented with good intentions, but they've been biologically ill-informed. They've been silly. Some of the things that we've invented have been belief systems that are destructive and hateful. Anti-Semitism is invented. Misogyny is invented. Racism is invented. There's no genetics that makes you hate somebody because they have a different skin color. Some of the things that we pass on are well-intended but stupid. And I hate to say this, I don't say this from a position of trying to be a know-it-all, but I just want to point out that there's certain biological strengths that we all have that allow us to function in a certain way. We have these certain biological genetic gifts, and if we act on these gifts in a sensible way, there's an incredible set of things that can happen. But if we're biologically disrespectful, if we create policy, practice, or law that's biologically disrespectful, it always fails. Communism, as a form of invented government, failed because it did not respect fundamental aspects of human nature. I believe that some of our child rearing practices currently are biologically disrespectful. Human beings, for 99.9% of the time we've been on this planet, lived in heterogeneous social groups. Elderly, babies, adolescents, children, adults, all mixed in together, all day long, spending time with each other. For every dependent child under the age of 6, there were 4 individuals who were more developmentally mature who could participate in caregiving. They could protect, could nurture, enrich, they could model behaviors. We've now defined it as a best practice in our world to have one caregiver for 4 children. That's 1/16 the number of relational opportunities during the day. This is a biologically disrespectful choice, and it has significant consequences, as I will point out through the rest of this presentation. The other thing about this accumulated experience and knowledge, these things we invent, if you don't actively pass them on, they're lost. Every generation makes choices. What do we teach our children? What language, what beliefs, what religion, what family recipes, what family traditions? And you either pass them on or not. And sometimes you invent a style of living together. We've invented this Western world where our children from the age 6 all the way through 18 spend 85% of their day outside of the home, which means that even though you're trying to shape their behavior and their functioning, you want them to reflect your values, they spend 85% of their day with other people whose values you can't control. They watch television for 5 hours a day, where the values that are permeating television and the media don't usually reflect the typical household. You can lose the accumulated wisdom from thousands of previous generations if you don't pass it on. And one of the saddest things that's happening in our culture is that we are throwing the elderly out of the lives of our young children. The wisdom of multiple generations of caregiving and observing and learning, we throw it away. The result is this incredible irony that we live at a time in the history of our species when we actually know more facts about what's good for children than ever before in the history of our species. If you go into our academic settings, if you go into our libraries, if you look at the studies out there about what's good for children, we know more than ever before. The problem is, however, we do not have policies and practices that reflect those facts. Those facts have not been turned into knowledge, and they certainly haven't been turned into common knowledge. You can take the average person off the street and look at the way they raise their kids. They don't know fundamentals about how to help a baby sleep. They don't know fundamentals about how important it is to speak to your child and read to your child. They don't know the fundamentals about how to develop a disciplinary style that doesn't require beating a child when you get frustrated. They don't understand that. We've never taught that to them. And part of the reason that children are growing up to raise children is because we've created a style of living that is relationally different from the way we're designed. Human beings, as I said, spend almost all the time on this planet living in these extended family models, multi-family extended family models, 40 to 50 people. In any continuous living group, there were 40 or so people. By 1500 in the West, that was down to 20. 1850 in the U.S., it was down to 10. 1960, down to 5. And in the last U.S. census, there were fewer than 3 people in a typical American household. And in those households, they were watching television 4 or more hours at a time. They weren't sitting face-to-face and having conversation. They weren't eating family meals. They were ordering out, and they were watching TV. Now, I mean, we sort of laugh about it because we all sort of do a little bit of that, but the fact is that has significant consequences for the way your brain develops. If you grow up in an extended family model and you're 5 years old, you see teenagers, 10-year-olds, you see babies. And you're 8 years old, you take care of the 5-year-old. You're 12 years old, you take care of the babies. You get to be child-rearing age, and guess what? Not only do you know the prevailing child-rearing practices of your community, but you've had hands-on experience. In our society, it's not unusual that you could grow up as a single child, go to American public schools where we are so compartmentalized that first graders spend all day with first graders, second graders all day with second graders, that you can go all the way through to college, all the way through medical school, all the way through a pediatric residency, and literally have had very little hands-on experience with normal child development. The world that we've invented has a relational landscape that is dramatically different than the world that our grandparents lived in, or even our parents. And it is changing at a dramatic rate, influenced by television and influenced by the compartmentalization of the modern world. We separate from each other based upon age. We separate by socioeconomic. We literally have created, instead of this relationally enriched environment, we've created an environment where people are separate. Our children are growing up with material wealth beyond all comprehension. Children in poverty in the United States. If you look at their homes, on average, they have 2 color TVs. More than 65% of children in poverty who are adolescents have a cell phone. Our children are materially wealthy beyond all comprehension, but they are experiencing poverty relationships. They don't spend time with neighbors. They don't spend time with older kids. They don't spend time with younger kids. They don't spend a lot of time with their parents. They don't spend a lot of time with anybody, except a group of cohorts who are at the same developmental age that they are. Our children are not getting the sufficient number of relational opportunities as they grow up to fully express this genetic potential to be humane. You know, if human beings could spawn, just because you fed them and protected them from disease, if they would grow up and be humane, none of this would matter. All this relational stuff, who cares? Who cares what the relational milieu is? Doesn't matter. But the problem is this. Just as parts of the brain involved in reading only develop if you read, and parts of the brain involved in typing only develop if you type, parts of the brain involved in relating only develop if you relate. Poverty of words leads to speech and language underdevelopment. Impoverished children who are cognitively impoverished to grow up in a high-risk environment, by the time they're through, they've heard 750,000 words. In comparison to the 3 million words that a healthy child will hear. So which one of these kids, when they get to be 5, is going to be ready to learn? The brain develops in a use-dependent way. Let me just give you a visual image of this because it's important. It's important to understand that this is not just sort of some fuzzy, you know, socially emotional stuff. This is biology. These are neurons. This is a plate of living neurons, and you're going to see them move. And you're going to see what happens with repetition. You see here two neurons that are separate. And with stimulation, this is time-lapse photography. With stimulation, you'll see what happens under normal circumstances in the developing brain and in a brain that's acquiring new information. You literally create physical connections, neuron to neuron. So the more you practice your typing, the more the motor vestibular part of your brain gets patterned, repetitive stimulation. The more you read, the more the cognitive part of your brain responsible for reading and abstract cognition gets patterned, repetitive stimulation. The more you interact with grandma and grandpa, and the more you hug your parents, and the more you have relational interactions with your neighbors and peers, the more the part of your brain involved in empathy and compassion develops. All right. So, human beings are fundamentally social creatures. The only thing that allowed us to survive on this planet was the ability to form and maintain relationships with other members of the planet. No individual human being is independent or has ever been independent or is capable of surviving independently. Human beings are interdependent. We are designed to live and work and die in groups. And the huge parts of our brain are dedicated to that. In fact, you cannot find a single aspect of motor, cognitive, self-regulation functioning in your brain that isn't one neuron away from some aspect of relational neurobiology. If you want compassionate citizens who are wise, not just smart, we have to be concerned about the relational milieu they grow up in. Human beings aren't born humane. They become humane. Now, let me just show you a little bit about this. I haven't gone into it too much, but the fact is, when you have eye contact with another human being, and when you get a hug from another human being, you shake hands with another human being, you have a conversation with another human being, all of those things, visual input, auditory input, tactile input, all of those things are physical energy that are turned into patterned neuronal activity that go up into parts of the brain and get processed. So that in the human brain, when you have an interaction with somebody who is safe and familiar, you literally feel safer. Your stress response systems are more smoothly regulated. You get a little bit of pleasure. Literally, the pleasure centers in your brain get stimulation. And everybody in this room knows that. When you sort of have someone come up and say they're very proud of what you've done to represent them, it just makes you feel good. It's rewarding. When somebody comes up and gives you a hug in your family, it's rewarding. It gives you a little bit of physiological burst of health. So, if you are in an environment where there's relational health, this is what happens. This is a 24-hour contact map with a healthy child. Now, this is what happens in one day with this child. And this is 6 in the morning, this is noon, this is 6 at night, and this is midnight. Every one of these little yellow arrows is one of these positive interactions. If the little yellow arrow goes to the inner circle, that's with a family member. The next circle out is with friends. This is acquaintances, like classmates. And this is with a stranger. And during the course of this day, what happens to this child is he has a little bit of burst of physiological health and another burst, a little reward, little reward, little reward, little reward. And guess what? Over the course of the day, he has dozens upon dozens of learning opportunities, dozens upon dozens of opportunities to have the physiology of his health maintained and sustained. This is a healthy child. He gets to be age 10, and he's had the normal number of social-emotional experiences that a 10-year-old you'd want in a 10-year-old. So he's chronologically 10, and he has social-emotional skills of a 10-year-old. This is a high-risk child. In fact, this is the best day in a week for a high-risk child. This high-risk child actually had 2 days during this time when not one single human being had a positive interaction with him. This child was invisible. He was around people, but nobody looked at him, nobody talked to him, nobody said good things to him. And of course, this child gets to be age 10, and he's only had the normal number of social-emotional opportunities that a 4-year-old would have. So you've got a 10-year-old body, a 10-year-old chronologically, who's functioning like a 4-year-old, which leads to tremendous problems with peers, tremendous problems in school. Furthermore, let's say these kids both get to be age 12. This child and this child both go to a party where they're introduced to methamphetamine. Now, I sort of alluded to it, but I didn't explicitly say this. Literally, when you have a positive human interaction, it stimulates the part of your brain involved in euphoria and pleasure. So this child directly gets that euphoria center stimulated by cocaine or amphetamine or whatever drug of abuse it is, and he compares it to what his normal day is like. And his brain says, that's pretty good, but, you know, it's not that much better than what I already got. This kid says, unbelievable. I've never had anything like this in my life. Children with relational poverty are much more vulnerable to drugs, using drugs of abuse in a way that leads to dependence and addiction and makes it incredibly difficult for them to get off that. The second thing that happens with these kids are much more vulnerable to other ways of getting this pleasure stimulation met in a maladaptive way. Those of you interested in the health problems, obesity is a huge problem with our kids. Another way to stimulate the pleasure centers in the brain, aside from human relationships, is to eat salty, fatty, sweet foods. So people end up eating, even when they're not hungry, if they're in this situation than if they're in this situation. Relational health is related to a whole host of physical, emotional, and social risk factors. You take somebody who's got relational health, and they're much less likely to have teen pregnancy, they're much less likely to have aggressive violent behavior, they're much less likely to have asthma, heart disease, lung disease, they're much more capable of tolerating the inevitable stressors of life, and they're much less likely to fall prey to drugs and abuse. This child, in contrast, is essentially going to be at greater risk for all of those things. So, one great biological gift that we have to figure out how to act on is our relational nature. How do we recapture relational health in our communities? The second great gift I'm going to talk about is early childhood. They are interrelated. What I want you to appreciate is that the brain, this brain that you have and that I have, that allows us to think and walk and talk and love and do all these things, it is a biological organ that develops. It doesn't start out as a fully organized brain. It develops. In utero, a tremendous amount of brain growth takes place. And at birth, you've got the vast majority of neurons in your head that you use today. Now, you make new neurons and you grow new neurons as you get older, but in comparison to the neurons that were born in utero, it's very, very small. The way these neurons organize into functional systems is just the same way neurons change with experience once you develop. Development and learning use the same biological principles. Neurons change with repetition, use-dependent development. You take a child and you provide them opportunities for motor activity, and they will develop the motor systems in their brain. You provide them with opportunities for social experiences, and they develop the social systems in their brain. This process, the process of change and growth, is, as you've heard earlier, incredibly front-loaded. Now, you change from the moment of conception to the moment of death. Your brains are changing right now. But the rate of change in your brain, the rate at which you're acquiring new information now, is so minuscule compared to the rate at which your brain is changing earlier in life. So this moment from here, from this single cell to this little child, is 2 years. The physical equivalent of going from here to here would be if I grew to be the size of Iowa in 2 years. It's an astounding, rapid, physical process that's very energy dependent. It's so energy dependent that at birth, you use 63% of the calories you take in your brain, take in or used by your brain. 63%. Right now, only 18% of the calories you take in any given day are used by your brain. And I think, I'm not sure whether Republicans or Democrats are higher or lower than I say. Brain development is tremendously front-loaded. So if you look at this, just this again, just a visual comparison of the size of the infant's brain in relation to the size of an adult brain, you can see that it's significantly more a percentage of the body than in an adult. Physical growth of the brain from birth through five, there's this growth period and then there's a plateau. It doesn't mean the brain isn't changing. But in comparison to the rest of the body, which grows linearly, in a linear fashion from birth to 20, this is a different growth pattern. By the time your brain, by the time your child is 4 years old, the brain is 90% adult size, which is a very amazing gift. That incredible growth in the first years of life is a time when, if the mother and the father and the family can create an environment that's safe, predictable, nurturing, and just minimally cognitively enriching, you can get incredible organization of these fundamental systems that will, for the rest of your life, determine how you function. Now, it doesn't suggest it's not too late if you miss that, but this is a gift that we have to figure out how to take advantage of. And it's part of the challenge that you have. How does government invest in this without invading the right of the family to determine how to raise their children? Let me give you a couple of simple examples of what can happen if that gift is grossly disrespected. If you take a child when they're developing and you do not provide appropriate stimulation, you can get a whole range of terrible, terrible outcomes. So, for example, if you take a child and you raise them in an environment where they are not spoken to, they will not speak language. If you raise a child in an environment where they are not held, they will not, well, if they're infants, there's a significant probability that they'll die. There's lots of different ways you can neglect kids. Let me just show you an interesting example of how, this is actually quite a sobering picture, if I can get this to work here. I'm the very sobering picture here. This is a child who at 18 months wandered away from her alcoholic mother into an abandoned apartment complex in Ukraine and lived with a pack of dogs. Rather than learning language, she learned all the nonverbal motor communication and social-emotional communication skills of a dog. She was taken out of that environment when she was, I think, 7 or 8. They taught her the rudiments of language, but she never learned the full richness of language. And essentially, whenever she was overwhelmed, she would revert to her brain organizational state that was associated with her early experiences. Let me show you another one. This is a little boy who spent the first 2 years of his life living in an environment where there's domestic violence. And at age 3, he was taken out of that environment and put into a very loving home, where for the next 7 years, they provided consistency, predictability, love, nurturance, all kinds of wonderful things. He internalized somehow in his brain that whenever he did anything wrong, he should be punished. So he would, because his new parents would not beat him or put cigarettes out in him or choke him or scratch him, he would go off and do that on his own. And, you know, this video is quite long, actually, and it shows a lot of instances of him self-punishing. This actually happened one day because he was having a picnic with his neighbors, and he happened to spill his Kool-Aid outside. And the parents and the neighbors said, "There's no problem, don't worry about that." But he removed himself, went off into the corner, and started to do these self-abusive behaviors. Now, he's been getting incredibly expensive therapeutic services for years, and they are just barely able to help him avoid doing this. The point being to all of this, and I don't want, this could go on and on and on, but it's pretty disgusting. The point to all of this is early childhood, early experiences have a profound impact on the way children develop. Some of the most sobering experiences of neglect that we've seen are kids that have had profound sensory deprivation, and this illustrates the importance of early childhood. If you take children who, in the first 3 years of life, when their brain is most rapidly growing and you do not provide them with appropriate experiences, you end up with profound abnormalities. And again, I think many of you are familiar with the story of the Eastern European orphanages. There are lots of these children who spent the first 3 years in these environments that were physically sterile in terms of disease. They were given food, but they were also essentially given very, very, very minimal social interactions. This is a child who spent the first 3 years of his life in a room where there were 60 other cribs. And a caregiver would come in and feed and diaper, and then feed and diaper, and then feed and diaper. And this child probably had 12 minutes of adult contact a day. He was adopted at age 3 by a wonderful family who spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars on OT, PT, speech and language, mental health services. And for the next 5 years, they slowly crept him forward. He did make progress, but it was unbelievably expensive. And it was very, very laborious. And even at age 8, this is the level of his development. This is his drawing. You can see it's quite abnormal for an 8-year-old. And this is why. This is a normal brain. This is a brain of a 3-year-old child whose head is in the 50th percentile. This is an average kid. This is the brain of a child raised in a neglectful situation. He was raised in a cage in the U.S. You can see the brain is small. You may not appreciate this, but this is kind of underdevelopment of the cortex. These big spaces here are called ventricles. They should be much smaller because there should be more brain substance. This is another child, different child, normal brain here, 50 percentile. This is a child whose brain was raised. He was raised in the basement room by his parents, who thought he was possessed by a demon. Basically, it was another neglectful situation. But when he was removed about age 3, same thing. Underdeveloped brain, completely under-socialized, huge spaces where there should be brain substance. This is the brain of a Romanian orphan. Again, huge spaces in the cortical matter where there should be brain substance that would be involved in having him function normally. This is, again, abnormal. I don't want to talk about that. All right. Just to make this is probably one of the most sobering things I'm going to show you today. This is actually an illustration of the potential value of an early surveillance and intervention model. And it's the only sort of complicated slide I'm going to show, so bear with me while I sort of explain this. If you take all these children who are neglected and remove from these neglectful environments, if they were removed in the first year of life, they had a small brain, and if you just put them in a regular foster placement, no special services, no really expensive intensive services, just regular foster care, 1 year later, there was significant recovery. 25% of these kids enter the special education system, and we estimate will cost about $1 million to taxpayers. 25%. If these children were removed in the second year of life, small brains, a year later, less recovery, about 50% of these children enter the special education system. Third year of life, small brains at time of removal, they spent at least 2 full years in that neglectful environment. They were removed in the second, third year of life. 1 year later, with no special services, there was recovery, but not very much, and about 75% of these kids entered the special education system. And if they were in that environment for 3 full years and then removed, 1 year later, there was very little change, very little progress, and these kids, 100% of these kids, entered the special education system and cost $1 million by the time they're 20 to taxpayers. Now, the development of an intervention that would have a surveillance element capacity, if you could develop a surveillance model with an early intervention that reach the 60 highest risk kids in a given community and just diverted one of them out of this trajectory, you'd save, you know, basically would be a cost-effective program. It's a $1 million program. That would be an incredibly expensive program to identify these 60 kids. It probably wouldn't cost that much money. But if you only had a success rate of 1 out of 60, it would be cost-effective. Similar cost-effective interventions for early childhood therapeutic preschool models, for early childhood home visitation models, for early childhood enrichment models are out there. It is an economic and child-sensible thing to do, to invest in early childhood. Now, let me take 1 minute. Actually, I'm going to take a couple of seconds more and talk a little bit about another aspect of what happens to our young children. High-risk children, the kids that you end up spending lots and lots and lots and lots of dollars on, are very often impacted by having had exposure to traumatic stress. Stress in and of itself isn't bad. In fact, stress is really good for kids. Predictable, moderate stress is excellent. It's probably the best way to help a child become resilient. And predictable moderate stress is the kinds of stuff that happens when a child has an opportunity to explore and be challenged in context of a healthy, safe educational environment. So when a child goes into first grade, for example, and the teacher asks the student to stand up and recite A, B, C, D, that activates their stress response. It's a little bit anxiety-provoking, but it's moderate, it's predictable, it's not terrible. And they do that once, twice, 30, 40, 50 times, and ultimately they get to the point where they can stand up in front of their peers and they don't feel terrible. That's a very positive thing. Unfortunately, many, many of the kids that we work with, particularly those kids that come from these very overwhelmed families, have unpredictable and severe stress. And that leads to profound vulnerabilities and problems in the way they function. An example of what can happen with traumatic stress is illustrated in this slide that shows we worked with the Branch Davidian kids. You, I'm sure, remember those videotapes of the ATF raid on that compound. There were 43 or 44 kids in the compound at the time of that raid. 21 of them were released into our care over the next 3 days. We took care of them for weeks. And one of the things we did was take their heart rate. So these children had weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and even 5 days after the original assault, the resting heart rate for this group of kids was still 134, which is very, very, very high. So even though they were walking, talking, sleeping, functioning, they looked pretty normal in many regards, internally they were in a state of persistent fear. When that happens to a child in a domestic violence environment, a child in a physical abuse environment, a child with an overwhelmed caregiver, if a child grows up in an environment where their stress response system is persistently activated, it changes the normal linear relationship between external threat and internal state of response. So you and I, we wake up in the morning, and at baseline, no external threat, we feel relatively calm. We go off to work, and we're in a little bit of a state of vigilance. We're paying attention to the external world. We get into a car accident, and we have a little bit of an alarm response, but the car accident's minor. Nobody gets hurt. You go back home, and you move back down this arousal continuum. High-risk kids, in contrast, wake up when there's no external threat, and they're already in this state of high alarm. Their physiology is different, and that has profound impact on many things, not the least of which is their health. This is data from a study that was conducted by the CDC and a group in California that's looking at 17,000 adults and their health. If you look at individual health of an adult, your risk for having heart disease, lung disease, any of the bad things that kill you, and your risk for any other social ill, alcoholism, drink, domestic violence, your risk for any of these things is increased between 3- and 5-fold by virtue of having had early childhood trauma. So this over here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, these comorbidities are basically, think of those as bad things that taxpayers have to pay for. Now, these bad things could be health problems, it could be domestic problems, it could be all kinds of things, but the bottom line is, these are things that you pay for. And here, ACE are adverse childhood experiences, and as adverse childhood experiences go up, the things that you have to pay for over the course of their lifetime go way up as well. Trauma changes the way people function. If you have children who are in a domestic violence environment, for example, their ability and their baseline when they wake up in the morning is that they're in an alarm state instead of being in this relatively calm state. They go to school. This is a part of the brain that processes information. This is a part of the brain that processes nonverbal threat-related signals. These kids, when the teacher is giving a lecture, their brain is not paying attention to the words. Their brain is paying attention to the nonverbal cues. These kids develop street smarts, but not book smarts. I can tell you right now that one of the biggest problems that you face in education in this and any state is not that your curriculum's bad, not that your teachers are bad, not there's all kinds of things that we're pointing our fingers at. The problem is that instead of having 1 out of 10 kids entering school who's chronologically 6 and developmentally 4, you're now getting 6 and 7 kids out of 20. You're getting 2 and 3 and 4 out of 10 who are developmentally unprepared to learn. And a big component of that is that so many of these kids are coming from chaotic environments, and they come into these classrooms in these high arousal states, and they can't function. The further you go along this arousal continuum, the dumber you get. Now, this is true for individuals, but it's also true, and I'm taking liberties here, this is also true for governments. And I'm completely serious about this. It's true of organizations. Organizational planning and thinking follows the same rules as individuals. If you have an organization that's resource limited and unpredictable in their funding, the prevailing tone in that organization is anxiety. The problem-solving approach is the immediate future. The solutions are overly simplistic, and the cognitive reflection of those solutions is very concrete. It's not abstract. Everybody in this room has been involved in changing policy driven by headlines. Crisis-driven creation of policy and practice happens all the time. Bureaucracies are permeated with this. Part of our problem is that we haven't figured out how in our modern governmental system to create islands of calm where there's more predictable funding that would allow people to feel safe and then use the smart part of their brain to problem solve. Too many of our solutions are focused on the funding cycle or the election cycle and not on the developmental cycle. But I'm just going to do what I want to do. I know I feel like a complete hog here taking all the time and talking. I really would love to have some conversation about this, but let me just end by saying that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of hope in what I say. A lot of people get pessimistic when I talk about the incredible, indelible impact of trauma and neglect. They get discouraged when I talk about how we've invented ourselves in this culture into a corner, which I believe we have. Television, compartmentalization of our communities, the fragmentation of our policies, these are huge problems. But I do think that we should be hopeful because we do have opportunities to make changes in the way we spend our money and spend our time. I think that as you're doing this problem-solving process, figuring out what to fund, what not to fund, how to listen to this, don't ever listen to anybody who comes up and says they have the program. I know you probably already learned that, but there is no one program that's going to solve these complex problems. These are multi-domain and multi-dimensional, and in fact, it's, you know, in the least expected ways, very positive things can happen. If you create policy and practice and law that reflect biological reality. The first thing is anything you do, whether you're funding public spaces, whether you're funding education, whether you're funding health and human services, anything you do that helps create and community is going to help children. We know that the best predictor for individual health in a child isn't actually family characteristics, it's community health characteristics. So if you go into a community and you look at aspects of, is there an active church? Is there a healthy school? Is the grocery store close enough to walk to? Do they have volunteerism in this community? If you have all those elements in those communities, the children that come out of those communities are healthier globally. That's a better predictor of their global health than if you were to go to individual household by household and look at what's going on in a given house. I think everybody in this room kind of knows this stuff. I grew up in Bismarck, North Dakota. There was a kid on my block, nice kid, but his father beat the hell out of his mother all the time, beat him up. Everybody knew it. Horrible, bad situation. But because we were a very healthy community, this child ended up eating at our house one night a week, and another house another night a week, and he'd go, every coach knew it, every teacher knew it, and everybody gave him a little bit of a break. They were more tolerant, they were more understanding. Now, he had crap at home, but he had community help. When I was in Chicago, I did a lot of work with kids that lived in the Robert Taylor homes, big projects. And in these homes were lots of, in these high-rise tenement homes, basically, were lots of families, two parents, God-fearing, you know, the working poor. But as soon as those kids left that house, that apartment, they were in an environment that was gang-infested, threatening. They had to take two buses to get to a grocery store. They had to take three buses to get to their church. Complete community deterioration, and every one of those kids developed trauma-related symptoms. The other thing that's hard when you're trying to make law, the fundamental thing that makes us better is people. It's not programs. You can go to an early Head Start program in one community and it sucks. And then you can go to an early Head Start program in another community and it's dynamic, it's active, it's engaged, it's unbelievable. It's the people that do this job. I mean, anybody who actually follows sports knows that it's not the job description or the rules of the game that determine how you win. It's the people. Look at the Patriots. Right? I mean, seriously. They purposely recruit to a certain kind of person. Anything you do, any program that you develop, anything you fund, any law you write that encourages increasing the number and quality of relationships in kids' lives, it's going to work. It's going to be positive. And any program that you fund that doesn't do this, it's not going to make your community better. Period. Every time we create law, policy, and practice that capitalize on our biological gifts, we get better as a species. And every time we create policy, practice, or law that's disrespectful of our biology, we get sick. Socially sick, cognitively sick, emotionally sick, it doesn't work. Communism is a great example. The two big gifts I've talked about, recapturing relational health and acting on this window of opportunity in early childhood. This is a very amazing thing, this window. This is the ease with which the brain can be changed and modified and molded. Now, you can change the brain over here when you're 25, when you're 35, when you're 75. But it's harder, and it takes more money. And this is how we spend money in our public systems to change the brain. Mental health services are trying to change the brain, juvenile justice, education, all these things. You're not trying to change the pancreas. You're trying to change the brain. But you're doing it at a time when the brain is much harder to modify. Figuring out ways to act on this gift that are also respectful of family and the values of our community and culture is a challenge. But I do think that there are ways to do this. And I know that there are people that are doing this already in Oregon. And I think that it's worth trying. Because if we can do this, if we can capture this potential, you will decrease by at least 25 to 30% the number of people and problems you have to serve out here in the juvenile justice, criminal justice, substance abuse, and mental health systems. So, the challenge, of course, is that you live in the political world. And you have to spend today's dollars as a bet on outcomes 20 years from now. It takes a lot of political capital to do that kind of thing. I think it's worth doing. I think it's worth trying to explain to your constituency why you would do something like this. And I do think that when your constituency understands this, that they will certainly be more forgiving of use of dollars that may not seem to have immediate accountability and outcomes that you can point to in a year or two or three. The real outcome of raising a child is when they're 25, 35, 45, 50, what they give back to the world. And it's really hard in our current political system to turn around and take credit for, you know, a 50-year-old's accomplishments based upon policies that were made 35 years previously. But somebody's got to step up and do it, because it's really the way we work. And if we don't capitalize on the way human beings work, and we continue to be accountable not to our biology, but accountable to these systems that we've created, we're never going to meet our full potential. So, thank you for your time, and I look forward to some conversation about what do you do with all this. Thanks.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Boone.
Wow. Can you speak to prevention? And finally, I mean, I've been kind of going down that route for a long time, since the 70s, and I'm so glad to finally have people coming to us and, you know, both in this community and around our state, around our country, and around the world. They're finally agreeing that this really simple thing is right in our hands. And I have a 4-year-old granddaughter, and I'm always amazed at how much trust there is put in me as a grandmother. Of course, she knows me, but in other people, and even though she's shy, but how even other strange children to me, I see a small child, how much power we hold over them with this trust. And how what we do, just even simple things like paying attention to them, spending time with them, can make such a huge difference in the end. So that was my little editorial. I do have a couple of questions. So how best can we address the early childhood trauma element
What if it doesn't show its face until later? And how late can it wait to surface, like age or do events trigger it? And how will it manifest itself? And how will we know?
Well, it's the sad reality that you point out is very often the initial manifestations of trauma or neglect don't show up until later in life. So, in fact, the first point in the public systems where we really see these kids tends to be public schools. And we identify ultimately that they're struggling. We identify it as an academic problem or a behavioral problem initially. And then only later on, once the educator refers to a clinician, is there sometimes the connection between all the crap that's happened as they grew up and how they're functioning now. I can tell you right now, one of the sort of the mental health system's increasing attention to the issue of ADHD, attention deficit disorder, and the overuse of psychotropic medications, a huge part of that, at least in our sampling, and certainly within the foster care system, isn't because these kids have ADHD. These kids have trauma-related changes in their brain. And it looks just like ADHD, but if you are an overworked clinician and you're seeing 35 kids a day and you don't get a full history, you see these symptoms and you say, well, that looks like ADHD, so let's try Ritalin, and you're off to the races. So that's one of the ways that it manifests. The other way it manifests, interestingly enough, is in the healthcare system. In California, the 4% of kids that are in foster care consume like 65% of their Medicaid dollars in mental health and about 30% in healthcare. So these kids have, when your stress response neurobiology that kind of controls your heart and your lungs and your gut, these kids have asthma a lot more frequently, they have gut problems, they have diabetes. It literally, it shifts their whole life curve. And the morbidity, because these are not, and I don't want to talk about this in a completely sort of crude economic way, but the fact is these individuals don't pay taxes, so their illnesses are tax consuming. Their physical illnesses, their mental illnesses are tax consuming. And the earlier we could identify these kids, if we, you know, just and provide interventions that would change that trajectory, I think the better off it would be.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. It's a very sobering presentation. Are you familiar with a program, Healthy Start, that started, was that 4 years ago? And so, how do you feel about that?
I'm familiar with a lot of different Healthy Starts. There's the Healthy Start model that came out of Hawaii, and there's different labels given to early intervention models. To specifically comment on what that is here, I don't know exactly what it is.
I guess my interest is more prevention rather than dealing with problems, even early identified problems.
Right.
So do you have any suggestions for us on how we can prevent these kinds of problems in early childhood?
Sure. Well, this program that you mentioned already may be doing this, but there are a number of intervention models that identify at-risk mothers. So that even when they are first brought to the attention of a public system, that here's a single parent who's 22, who doesn't have a job, didn't finish high school, has previously known to us because she's been in the mental health or child protective or juvenile justice system, and now she's pregnant. You don't have to be a rocket scientist, and you don't need to do a formal assessment to know that that's going to be an at-risk child. So there are programs that pair somebody, an individual like a visiting nurse or a doula program, which would be more like a more experienced grandmother-like person who's trained to spend time with this mother over the course of her pregnancy, form a relationship where this mother trusts her, which is basically the only vehicle for making this mother listen to what that person has to say. You can come in with all the content. I mean, I can come in and tell you what to do. and I, because I know a lot of stuff, but the fact is, if you don't trust me, you're not going to listen to any of that. So the key part of these, the programs at work, is that they are relational. So in context of those relational interactions, what happens is these mothers begin to trust that person a little bit. They listen to what they say when they come after the birth and help track these kids and help the mothers get a little bit more comfortable. They help plug them into existing supports in the net in the community. Because there's lots of communities that have, you know, right down the block there's a Mother's Day drop-in at a church and the mother may not even know about it. So there's this individual plays a key role. And when you track the outcomes of these programs, the children have a much higher probability, and they've tracked this over 15 to 20 years, higher probability of graduating from high school, higher probability of getting a job where they pay taxes. They have a lower representation in the juvenile justice and criminal justice system. And so those programs are very effective. And I cannot tell you how important it is to begin to create a perspective in the way we do all of this work so that we are more preventative and proactive.
Okay, Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Oregon South and Star probably looks more like Hawaii's than other states, including the screening model, but because that's kind of what we modeled after to a degree. But that's not my question. My question, getting back to, it's something Senator Morissette and I have been concerned about for several years, is the fact that we do have overworked clinicians that are diagnosing kids with mental conditions that they're treating with drugs, which in my opinion, and in many, many cases, are totally inappropriate, because it's just putting a Band-Aid on something and not getting at the core causes of it, and you spoke very well to that. I guess what I'm wondering is how do we create the argument, the awareness that we need to be looking in a different direction, other than, you know, I mean, other than treating symptoms that are not necessarily manifest of what the real problem is with these kids.
You know, honestly, that's a. I had a discussion yesterday in Klamath Falls with people about this. One of the issues they have down there is that most of the medications that are being prescribed for children are being prescribed by general practitioners, and because they don't even have access, let alone, you know, to a child psychiatrist, not even to an adult psychiatrist. So the capacity and access issues are a big problem. And I think, unfortunately, the broader field, medicine, mental health, really has to start to self-police the way they train people. We are too easily influenced, in all honesty, by the pharmaceutical companies that have a tremendous amount of power in shaping what goes in the journals, what gets funded, funding of positions and residency programs. So a lot of people are walking out of training programs, and all we've learned to do is to chart in a way that will prevent them from getting sued and to prescribe medications. And that's a problem with our field and we'll have to sort of clean that up a little bit. I think the other perspective that is that we really need to have a broader educational element across all sectors about the power of some of these other phenomena. And it's interesting that most physicians actually have learned about early childhood and brain development, not because of what they learned in school, which is you'd think they'd learn this in medical school or residency, but they've learned it because their clients, their patients, have come in and said, did you read this article in Time Magazine? Did you see Scientific American's thing about early childhood and trauma? And they read it. And so we have to figure out how to make some of this content common knowledge. And one approach to that that we've been piloting in Michigan is that we think a lot of this fundamental information is useful for you, whether you are a policeman or an attorney or a legislator, whatever you are, like a parent. So we think that this content, elements of this content, should be integrated into our public school curriculum. So we've worked with the Michigan, several school districts in Michigan, and developed a 30-hour curriculum on early childhood and brain development that's being used and is very likely to be recommended as required for graduating from high school in Michigan sometime in the next year or two.
I just want to interject. It's interesting because we were able to pass a psychotropic drug restraining bill last time with the assistance of the representative of Novartis, the company that makes Ritalin. He was the one who got us the votes to pass that because his own child was pressured, or they were pressured, to put their child on Ritalin. And he said, no, that's not his problem. He's very intelligent, and he's impatient, and he's bored.
Yeah.
And so, but it was interesting that it was the pharmaceutical company that helped us pass that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's maybe a comfort or a disturbing thought to think that I've learned about early brain development from the same place medical professionals do, but because I read the same articles, and to be quite honest, my interest in the field began when I started chairing human service committees. So I guess I'm not your normal farmer. Probably in many ways. it's been a frustration to me because when you look at the increasing number of diagnoses of HDHD or whatever letters they want to put on these things, and I'm saying, okay, what environmentally is happening to create all of these sudden outbreaks? And at the same time, you look at what's happening in communities and in families, and the fact that we get less and less two-parent families, and we get more and more kids with emotional problems, and
right.
We get more splintered communities. And to me, it's always been kind of apparent that it's cause and effect here,
right.
and it's not that suddenly brain chemistries have gone off the chart or something like that. So I guess part of my frustration, and you spoke to it, is, one of the things that's hard for us to do is put money and policy into things that we aren't going to see the results of in our time in the process, because people, or at least we think that people, expect to see immediate results for a dollar spent. We need to show results. And so it's been a frustration for me as to how we put this puzzle together. I've been involved in a lot of early childhood stuff for a long time in this building. And the frustration for me is how do we get the public and the people in this building and other buildings like this aware of the connections and start doing things more appropriately than the way we're doing them now. I needed to let off some steam.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Representative Boone.
Taking it just a hair back to the trauma event, how prevalent is what used to be multiple personality disorder, now DID? Do you see in your practice?
We actually see lots of kids who have been traumatized and who dissociate.
Mm-hmm.
And as they get older, some of them end up meeting criteria for various forms of dissociative identity disorder and so forth. The classic media presented multiple personality is quite rare, but there are lots of kids, however, who have been maltreated and traumatized who have, it's not really full blown multiple personalities, they just have the equivalent of like multiple personas. That it's not a full-blown personality. They just, under certain circumstances, they'll use a certain adaptive style that's very immature and very baby-like. And then when they're in a safe environment, they'll be able to act more mature. And it's essentially a magnification of the way we all are. I mean, all of us, when we get sleep-deprived and tired and frustrated, we sort of act you know, we say things we shouldn't say, when we act less mature. But when we feel safe and comfortable and secure, we kind of act like we're smart, bright, and all that kind of stuff. So, but these kids sort of have that to the extreme, and we see a lot of that.
How do you treat it?
You know, that's where the treating children who have dissociative symptoms is one of the hardest things to do, because you guys, I'm not sure how much you all know about this. Let me just give it just a moment of description of what that means. When somebody's under threat, their brain basically takes in this information and makes a determination of about two things. Is this threat something that I can fight away or run away from, or is this an unavoidable thing? If it's something that they think the brain says you can fight or you can flee, you activate this fight or flight response. If your brain says, I can't get away from this, you basically do what a possum does when it gets threatened. You literally shut down, and you do what we call dissociate. Under one condition, your heart rate goes way up and you get ready to fight. In the other condition, your heart rate goes way down and you get prepared to get injured. So these are both very adaptive. But the sort of the switch point is how your brain determines whether you can avoid it. So if a child ends up with one of these hypersensitive dissociative responses from trauma, and you get them into a therapeutic interaction, and you start to talk about something that's traumatizing, let me just see if I've got an example here. You start to talk about one of these things, and I guess I don't, but if you have a fight or flight response, your heart rate will go up and you'll sort of get combative and restless and look like an ADHD child. If you dissociate, you literally sort of have this robotic, overly compliant response where you look like you're there, but you're not. So it's very hard to teach these children anything. It's hard to engage them in an appropriate way. They're literally, it's like they're physically there, but they're mentally not there. So the key to treating these kids is actually to be essentially present and non-threatening and present and non-threatening and present and non-threatening, and little by little by little they feel safe enough with you to sort of tolerate some of the emotionally charged content of you know, the trauma. And it's a very long and very difficult process. And I can tell you right now, there's not a mental health system, a public mental health system in the United States that's set up to treat kids that have dissociation, because it takes a lot of time. And it takes a very skilled, consistent therapist. And if you look at the turnover rates of our clinicians in our public systems, every 2 or 3 years. If you look at the transience in the lives of these kids who have dissociative symptoms because of, you know, from the foster care system, you know, they move from one jurisdiction to the next, so they might be appropriate for this mental health system. So the combination of their transience and the transience of the system, and in Houston, our public system, you can't even get into senior in the child mental health system unless you're actively psychotic or suicidal. So, I mean, our child mental health systems in the U.S. are just a mess.
Representative May and Representative Anderson.
Oh, thank you. I'm still back to prevention and being proactive rather than reactive, and early identification, not only of at-risk children, but at-risk parents, new parents. So is that what you're referring to? You're talking about the Michigan pilot program?
Yes.
Okay. And my brain is whirling around. I'm trying to think, how can we identify parents like that? And one idea would be to work with obstetricians.
Absolutely.
Who are dealing with pregnant women to help them identify at-risk mothers and help provide services within a doula or visiting nurse or something that would be helping a pregnant mother. Is that the kind of thing that you would recommend?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Essentially the psychosocial screening or surveillance that you're suggesting would be incredibly inexpensive. You could ask, you know, 30 questions, and you'd be able to identify the most at-risk parents, and therefore better be able to target your limited prevention dollars. And I've always felt that there's this huge gap in our sort of our public systems when it comes to children. We have legislation and we have health surveillance that's required when they're babies.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this big gap until they're 5 or 6. So there's this window of where they're outside of the scrutiny of anybody in the public systems. So I really do think that, you know, believe me, I'm not big on government. I mean, you know, government has done, in many ways, they screwed up a lot of stuff they tried, well-intendedly tried to fix. But I do think that over time, we should move towards thinking about a surveillance model to identify these most at-risk families, because you're going to get your biggest bang for your buck if you work with them. And you're also going to be more effective working with... I can tell you one thing. This surveillance model is going to pick up the families that 85% of them are going to... You're going to work with them in a public... Your public dollar is going to work with them later on, whether in special education, child protection, anyway. So let's start at a time when we can have the most bang for our buck on helping these children have good outcomes.
And if I could just say one more thing. One of the bills that I had sponsored a while ago was a bill that would require the kind of parenting classes that you were talking in high school. And I was told by high school people that it should be earlier than that, because many young people will get pregnant before that,
right,
and they need to be. So what is your thought on that?
Well, I agree. We chose the high school level to start with because we, for several reasons. It was mostly it was because we needed to start somewhere. We're taking that content, and it is now being turned into something that's appropriate for middle school kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll keep getting earlier and earlier. It's interesting. We actually, even at the high school level, in the pre and post, what do you think about having a baby? Significant differences in the young mothers, young women basically saying, you know, I'm really not interested in having a baby until I'm this much older. And now, it's one thing to say it, and it's another thing to get pregnant, you know, the way people get pregnant. So, you know, that's a big issue. It's all of the cognitive training that we do, it sort of goes out the window. If you remember that chart, as soon as you get into a little bit more excited, a little bit more sort of anxious, a little bit more stirred up, a little bit more, a couple of drinks, that part of your brain that stores all that information that we learned in that prevention class, it's gone. So we have to figure out how to have real-life experiences that teach this lesson, not in a cognitive way, but in an affective way. And there is a program, for example, in Canada called Roots of Empathy, where it's not as much cognitive teaching about babies and children and all that kind of stuff, but what they do is they take a first-grade class. You know, this is just sort of an example. They'll take a first-grade class, and they'll take a pregnant mother. And that pregnant mother will come in, and week after week after week, they'll see her grow, and then the baby will be born, and they'll see the baby, and they get to know this child, and that mother and baby track with that first grade class, the second grade, third grade, and fourth grade, and it's a very interesting thing. This is a powerful lesson about biology. Just the tiniest little exposure to what is more biologically our predisposition to be around babies, even if you are of multiple ages, is enough to give these kids a very significant introduction to early childhood and the importance of, you know, how babies work, and they all sort of get a chance to feed and see things that they may not be seeing in their own homes. So there are little examples of programs out there that are moving towards preventative introduction of healthy caregiving practices without necessarily making it like the driver's ed. I mean, you know, driver's ed, the whole sort of written part of driver's ed, nobody remembers that. You remember driving, you get in a car and drive. That's the part where you learn. So we have to figure out, part of our challenge in our field is to figure out ways that will help teach these concepts without making them all these stale, abstract book lessons.
Representative Anderson.
That's me, Mr. Chair. It can take me about 3 days to sort through all that you said. It's been terrific.
Thank you.
I really relate to the things you're saying about relationships and the fact that our society has lost relationships and we're separated from each other. We're related to a TV tube instead of to people around us. I had the experience in a former life a number of years ago to deal with a lot of teenagers, and it impressed me that the kids who really I remember and who I built a great relationship with were kids who had a crisis in their life. Their granddad had just died, or their folks were divorcing, or they were having trouble in school, and they needed somebody to relate to. And that was, for me, it was tremendously relational and rewarding. Where are you seeing the successful rebuilding of relationship as you go around the country? What's happening? What are the groups that are seeing this? Is it Boys and Girls Club? Is it churches? Is it government? Is it Head Start? Is it Healthy Start?
There are examples of really wonderful sort of reweaving of social fabric in all of those. Mm-hmm. You know, the Boys and Girls Club of America, and they're fundamentally relational in all their programming. Now, they don't really, you know, they've always sort of done it, and when they hear me talk, they go, oh, that's why this works. You know, that's great, it works. People in mentoring programs sort of work that way. Some of the most interesting explicit, you know, once they sort of hear this and then they act on this, some of the most explicit program development has happened in San Diego, for example, where they've created 7 separate intergenerational programs. I just happened to be giving a presentation there about this stuff a couple of years ago when people in county government were present, and they said, hey, you know, maybe we should have our people that are responsible for the retired population meet with the people that do early childhood and meet with child people, and they ended up developing a lot of very interesting programs where they basically have settings where they have daycare for infants and for the elderly. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that it's wonderful for both of them.
Absolutely.
You know, they eat together?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. The same physical space, joint programming, they do things together, they sit at the same table and eat dinner, they eat their meals together, they do certain activities together. And it's wonderful because these elderly people have a lot to give. They don't like being thrown away and go play shuffleboard or whatever it is that you want you to do. They like the fact that they're teaching a child something and the child loves getting that special attention. So it's this wonderful win-win situation. And they've got several examples of that with different age children in San Diego. And Ontario has developed a set of early childhood centers that initially were designed to be these physical structures that did early childhood programming. But some of the communities just sort of almost by accident co-housed them with some of their other adult activities that they offered. And pretty soon what they found was just by putting them in the same space, you know, the little kids would wander over and hang out with the adults that were learning something, and then the adults would come over and hang out with the kids. And pretty soon they decided, hey, maybe we should actually, you know, really facilitate this. And it turns out that every time they do something, every time you put us together in the same space, we end up making connections. And I think one of the big issues here, honestly, is urban planning. I mean, the way we structure our homes, we have fences, and we don't have front porches, and we work away from where we live. And, you know, I think that there are literally important, concrete things about the way we build our public spaces that can bring people together in ways that will facilitate relationships. And, that, you know, there's a wonderful study that examine that, and Cabrini Green is another one of these high-rise things in Chicago, and they have like 4 blocks of these high-rise buildings. So they took one of these blocks and they built a park and they built benches and they built a playground for kids and literally made spaces for people to spend time. And what happened was people started to sit in the spaces and get to know each other, and the kids would play, and the rate of violent crime in that one high-rise decreased 30% over the next 9 months and stayed decreased over the next couple of years in comparison to all their high-rises.
Follow?
Yes. go ahead and follow up.
I think that's the experience that Mayor Goldsmith found in Indianapolis when he went to inner city and found a lot of the parks were just trash. And he went to different organizations and groups of parents and said, if I gave you $50 a month, would you cut the grass and clean up the trash? And pretty soon people were coming back in and being involved in your community.
Yeah.
I'm excited about something I'm seeing in my own home community where about 30 churches got together and said, look, there's about a 30-block area that's cooking meth and smoking dope and doing all kinds of crazy stuff, and the kids are really hurting. And they've decided that they're going to plant groups of families that are in that area and say, okay, now you reach out to your block, and you reach out to your block. Let's start penetrating our own communities. And if we don't have somebody in that community, we'll buy a house and put somebody in there to build a relationship.
Yep.
And I think I see in our little town possibilities of some just blockbusting changes in relationships, watching the families that are doing bad stuff and putting pressure on them and helping the families that are interested in change.
I do hear stories about that, maybe not that same level of getting 30 churches together, but there are examples in South City, L.A., where basically it was a church-based community reorganization, sort of stabilization and restructuring that took place. It started out with a Mother's Day drop-in, and then these mothers started to sort of get to know each other, and they said, boy, wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, somebody who could, you know, help us learn how to use computers. So it wasn't community-based. It was community-generated, which is a very different concept. And, you know, community-based is something that you come in from higher up and you say, oh, we're going to come to your community and base something here and you'll get to like it because we're smart and you're not. But community-generated is when you provide, you basically help facilitate the strengths in a community, and when they seek out your help or your resources, you're available to give them and help them grow. And that's what happened in L.A. in this church that ended up having this very dynamic continuing education thing for adults and GED program and early childhood center. And ultimately, they did this all basically with very little input from government. And essentially what they said was, just stay out of the way. You know, don't send inspectors and tell us we can't do this. Just, you know, when it's really bad, maybe, but, you know, just let us do our thing. And it worked out very well. Another really interesting example like that was a big block, lots of people of different ethnicities, but everybody was compartmentalized. Nobody was spending time with each other. One family said, you know what, my child got called, like, the N-word at school. So I want people to understand that I'm from Africa and I have a unique culture, et cetera, et cetera. So they invited everybody in the block to this dinner to come and eat come and learn about our culture. So your kids won't call my kid the N-word. One family came. But they had fun. And they decided, you know, next month, that family sent out invitations and three families came. Thank you very much. And ultimately what happened was, every month now, every family on this block gets together and has this communal meal. And it's reweaving social fabric.
One of the things that I think is interesting is that we have three mayors sitting up here. And I think all of us have had ways of bringing the community together. I had a series of prayer breakfasts, and the purpose of the prayer breakfast was to invite the religious community to come together and talk about how they could be involved in the civic community. And it worked, I thought, very well. In fact, you attended one of those. But and I think, I guess, the nature of the position is facilitator. If you're a mayor, you have an opportunity to, I didn't represent the city, I represented my constituents, and you figure out ways of getting people together. So it's not a governmental thing, but you have the power to do that. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is very fascinating stuff.
I was privileged to be raised in an extended family with 30 first cousins that were often around the family farm, and I certainly think I've enjoyed the benefits of that personally and been able to propagate that in my family, and I see it happening in my children's family. But as I've been involved in government, I have somewhat the experience of Representative Gordon over there. I believe that there will never be enough tax dollars to do this. I think it's people. And I think that there's a human resource that's available, largely untapped among those my age and older who are healthier, living longer, would benefit from the extended relationships. Years ago, I heard a man with great wisdom say that if your children don't have grandparents, adopt some.
Yeah.
And we have started in Washington County, Vision West, started by Top Down, reaching out to the faith community to become involved in delivering services that the government cannot afford to deliver. What I see that program failing is a failure to really go into the faith community and let them know what the opportunities are and what the needs are. And I believe that having experienced those values, my dad had a following of hundreds of kids. He had a little homemade tour that he would make like a railroad conductor, and he would lead these children out into the field, and he would let them feed the calf and pet the goat, and experiences that children today really don't have. But those kind of opportunities exist on the farms and in the fields around our cities today, where volunteers would gladly introduce children to a different world. If we don't begin to really re-engage people in this solving society's dysfunction, government can't do it. It's not something you pay people to do. It's something that it's a heart issue. And so I'm one that champions every opportunity to involve volunteers. And I think we can do that in more creative ways through the faith-based initiative at the national, state, local level. That would be a huge, huge benefit to society, short-term, long-term. So I appreciate what you've shared today. We've benefited from having similar presentations previously. But it's so obvious that children's capacity to grow that brain is so huge, and we don't provide the stimulation, the challenge, and the opportunities to do that we know how to do, really know how to do, but we just don't seem to have the motivation to make it happen. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you for your comments. And I
want to take advantage of the time remaining. Is there a volunteer in the audience who would like to come up and ask a question? This is your chance. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to come up and ask a question? Randy, you're sitting there with a big smile on you.
Oh, here he comes.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the Joint Committee. My name is Randy Frankie.
I'm the legislative liaison for the Coalition of County Children and Family Commissions.
Good. You're the right person to come up right now.
Thank you, I think. Let's test how fast I can think here on my feet to come up with a question. I guess let me first say, like all of you have said, I really appreciated the presentation and the information. It's brought back some of my studies when I was in college, and actually some of the learnings when I served as a county commissioner in Marion County for 24 years, that we really do need to focus on the early childhood, and the sooner the better to do that. In terms of, I think the biggest challenge, though, I think is the quote on there, and I believe in it sincerely, and that is, how do we mobilize or catalyze the community to step forward and participate? And I don't know. We are attempting to do that with the Children and Families Commissions in each of the counties, but I guess I would be interested if the speaker has any knowledge or examples of areas on a sort of a broad scale where he's seen that successfully accomplished.
Dr. Perry, you may not understand. Are you aware of the system that we're...
I think it's roughly parallels the system in California that I'm kind of familiar with, where there's county commissions that are basically involved in promoting and directing early childhood.
Right. Why don't you explain the mechanisms?
Yes, they're very similar. I'm familiar with California's. I had the pleasure to go down there and visit with some of the folks as they were developing that program. I would say, in our case, there's a Children and Families Commission in each county, primarily required to have a majority of citizens as opposed to professionals on each of those, and we actually provide some services and programs to kids 0 through 18, although a heavy emphasis on early childhood abuse and neglect prevention. And the state is generous to give us some flexible money, locally invested flexible money, where the local commissions maker, the citizens, can decide how they can try to utilize that resource to really multiply the impacts.
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, I think it's very smart to get decision making about how to spend money as close to the community as possible, which I think that each community will have a unique set of strengths and a unique set of issues that very often, and also will have a pool of people who have tremendous expertise and experience and make typically pretty good decisions about how to direct resources. And so I think that that's a wise model in general. I do think, however, that one thing that government can do, sort of broadly speaking, in this whole arena, is that I think sort of underlying all of these efforts in sort of the changing the direction, the way we want to change it, to promote reweaving social fabric, understand the importance of relationships, importance of children in early childhood, I really think there has to be more of an awareness about these issues at all levels and across all sectors of the public. So whether it's, you know, and again, I don't know, in California, they had some money to spend, and they continue to spend it on what are essentially public engagement and public education efforts. And when they say public, they're kind of broadly speaking. They have some materials that have been developed to promote for appropriate for parents. They've developed some specialized programs for people in law enforcement and judges. They've developed some specialized training approaches for educators and specialists who work with high-risk kids already, kids in CPS. I mean, one of the things that you brought up was that it's pretty sobering that you basically have had as much exposure to the importance of early childhood brain development as a typical pediatrician. But that's the case. You know, you can enter the child protective system from social work school and really have not learned anything about early childhood or neglect or trauma and now you're responsible for these high-risk families. And so we really have a capacity issue out there that I think can start to be addressed to some degree by better education. And that's a sort of a multidimensional approach. I mean, it's not just one curriculum or one, you know, set of materials. I think we need to think carefully about how do we permeate this content across our society so that all decision making in a family, all decision making in a local community, will lead to healthy choices. So, for example, the choices that have been made recently in, you know, in the last 10 years and the way people do youth sports. Since when do Wednesday nights and Sundays become completely fair game for practice and for games? Mm-hmm. You know, since when did the mealtime, you know, all of these, we've sort of made decisions that seem like they're in service of our children. But the fact is, they're undermining the fundamental strengths that our children need to sit down and have a family meal, to have Sundays reserved for family and for your faith, you know, if you believe, have a community of faith. You know, it's hard to do those things when you have a soccer game for your 8-year-old over here and a soccer game for your 12-year-old over there, and you're supposed to be in church. I mean, how do you promote community when you basically create things that are well-intended but undermining how we do things? And again, I think what would happen is if more people knew about these fundamental concepts, there'd just be far fewer people even suggesting that that's when we play soccer or that's how we play soccer. And that's just one example. There's all kinds of parents out there, well-intended, bright parents, who think that it's good for their parents to go from school to soccer practice, to violin practice, to homework, to go to bed at 11:30 and get up at 5:30 so that they can get to school on time. And these kids are sleep-deprived and they're overscheduled. And, you know, all of these things that even non-abusive, non-neglecting parents are doing are really, in the long run, undermining the fundamentals of a healthy development. So I guess my long sort of, you know, I ramble, I'm sorry. But the bottom line is we need to get this content out there in any way that we can. And anything the government can do to either nudge that along or in some cases underwrite that to some degree, that can be helpful. And I think that the most universal, this is why we chose to integrate this content into public schools. Because we think that that's the most universal, long-term way that content gets in the heads of our kids. And of course, we developed a curriculum for the American Academy of Pediatrics. We've developed a curriculum for the judiciary. We developed a curriculum for the FBI, for the Attorney General of California, for law enforcement. So the interesting thing is, all the same content, it's the same content that we're teaching in high school. It's just that it's got different examples to make it relevant for their work. So,
good. Thank you very much. Now, before we adjourn, would you like to talk a little bit about this, your website, www.childtrauma.org? Is that your website?
Yeah, that's the website of the organization I work with. Okay. And it is, it's... I think there's some useful stuff on the website. You know, we try to create materials that are useful for parents and caregivers, and some materials that are useful for more specialized disciplines, such as people that work in the child protective system. And then we have some real egghead research stuff. So, but there is content there that would be useful for people if they're interested in this subject.
Yes. Oh, an egghead. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. you do have material on the table, which I haven't seen yet, but I noticed that people are picking it up and so on. So thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's the second outburst, so I will adjourn the meeting.